Everybody's talking about it all over the world. They'll say, well, wait a minute, we're supposed to be protecting you from Russia, but why are you paying billions of dollars to Russia for energy? Why are countries in NATO, namely Germany, having a large percentage of their energy needs paid, you know, to Russia and taken care of by Russia? Now, if you look at it, Germany is a captive of Russia because they supply. They got rid of their coal plants. They got rid of their nuclear. They're getting so much of the oil and gas from Russia. I think it's something that NATO has to look at.
That's President Trump during today's NATO summit ripping into Germany about a gas deal that it has with the country of Russia. The president's comments came during a larger conversation about how much money other NATO countries have to, or at least should, spend on their defense. He railed against the organization as a presidential candidate, criticizing other member nations of taking advantage of the United States. And today, Trump called on them not only to meet an existing commitment to spend at least 2% of their GDP on defense, but to double it to 4%. That's even more than the United States spends itself. So what is he trying to do? Derek Chollet is executive vice president at the German Marshall Fund, and he's joining us on the line from Brussels. Hi, Derek.
Hi, great to be with you.
You bet. 4% of GDP, is that even possible for other NATO members? I mean, the United States spends a little more than 3.5%.
It's frankly a very unrealistic number, given, as you noted, the U.S. doesn't even spend 4% of its GDP on its own defense. It's for several presidents now, going back to President George W. Bush, it has been a longstanding U.S. goal to get NATO allies to spend more on their own defense and to meet the 2% threshold of their GDP on their defense. President Trump has put special emphasis on that goal since he's been in office. And I think in one sense, he can claim some credit for the fact that all NATO allies are spending more on their defense. And at this summit, 8 of NATO allies can say that they're at the 2% threshold or above it. But now by moving the goalpost to 4%, frankly, it's elicited a lot of eye-rolling here in Brussels.
A lot of eye-rolling. The president also bringing up this energy deal that we talked about just a moment ago between Russia and Germany. Why do you think he did that? I mean, he has said over and over again that he wants to be closer to Russia and make deals with President Putin there. So why would he have a problem with Germany having an agreement with Russia? Or does he have a problem with it?
To be honest, it's hard to discern what his motives are. Clearly, President Trump has had a special animus for Germany. He goes out of his way to criticize Germany, which has been a longstanding and loyal partner and critical partner of the United States over many, many years. Perhaps this is a way to try to deflect any criticism that he may be getting for the fact that he is trying to establish a close relationship with Putin, to try to point out that other NATO partners like Germany have relationships with Russia that are important. All I can say is that here in Europe, where there has been a lot of concern that President Trump would come into this NATO summit and act the same way that he did in the G7 summit several weeks ago in Canada, in which he came in seeming to almost be intent to be disruptive and to send a message of discord. And there was a lot of concern here in Europe and among many in the United States who care about the transatlantic relationship that he would do the same. And, of course, starting off his time here in Brussels with this seemingly unprovoked critical comments on Germany doesn't get things started off right.
I want to play another clip of tape here. This is an exchange between NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and the president, President Trump.
The good news is that the allies have started to invest more in defense. After years of cutting defense budgets, they have started to add billions to the defense budgets. And last year was the biggest increase in defense spending across Europe and Canada in a generation.
Why was that last year?
It's also because of your leadership, because your clear message.
So you hear Stoltenberg saying that last year Europe had the biggest increase in defense spending in a generation, that was because of pressure directly from President Trump, that his message is having an impact. But rather than take credit for that, like Stoltenberg seems to be trying to get him to do, Trump goes then into his complaints about Germany. What can we take from that?
Well, that is what is so puzzling about all of this, is that President Trump has shown that on many issues, he is willing to take credit even in areas where there's very little example of much progress. So, for example, in North Korea, where he had one meeting with a North Korean leader that didn't achieve very much, but yet he came home to the United States claiming that the North Korean nuclear threat was taken care of. So here's an instance where NATO diplomats, as we heard the Secretary General in your clip just say, well, NATO diplomats will concede that President Trump's singular focus on this spending issue has made a difference. It has lit a fire under European leaders. And yet even then, he won't claim credit for it, nor does he seem satisfied by it. In fact, then he's raising the bar by saying that it's not good enough to spend 2%, you must spend 4%, which is then leaving the question in many European leaders' mind and many others around the world is, can he ever be satisfied? And is this someone who's actually you can really do any deals with?
Yeah, like what is the ultimate goal here? Can he ever be satisfied? Yeah. Last week, Derek, you wrote that since Trump took office, the U.S. and its NATO partners have continued to lift their game. Those are your words. What have they been doing?
What's been agreed to at this summit is NATO partners will continue to develop their capabilities so military forces can get to the fight more efficiently and with more substantial lethality. NATO and the U.S. and its European partners through NATO have agreed to step up their efforts in a place like Iraq. They've agreed to continue the tough fight that they are in Afghanistan. And as the Secretary General of NATO has noted, they have agreed to increase their defense spending across the board. Every NATO ally has increased its defense spending. That's a good news story. But nevertheless, the news out of this summit is about how dissatisfied the United States is and whether or not the United States is actually going to remain committed to NATO. And that, to me, is a shame.
It's certainly a large cloud that hovers over Brussels right now. I know a few days ago, before all of this, the former ambassador to Israel under President Obama tweeted a long thread about how Trump's end goal is to pull the United States out of NATO. And indeed, Trump today, the first four words of a tweet that he sent this morning were, "What good is NATO?" What are your thoughts on perhaps a new world order or the things, I guess, given to what happened today in Brussels?
I think this raises the question. President Trump raises the question that if he follows through on his rhetoric, it will lead to a collapse of the NATO alliance. That won't be good for Europe. That will not be good for the United States. The only time that the NATO Mutual Defense Clause has ever been invoked in its history was after 9/11 on behalf of the United States. Your listeners should ask themselves, how many security allies do countries like China have? Or how many security allies do countries like Russia have? The answer is none. The U.S. through NATO has 28 security allies, countries that are committed to our defense and willing to work with us for our mutual defense. And that's a unique asset for the United States that I hope we do not squander.
Through Article 5, of course. And Derek Chollet, Executive Vice President for Security and Defense Policy at the German Marshall Fund. Derek, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, from a big summit to the small screen, big changes may be coming to HBO if the network's new corporate boss has its way. AT&T now owns HBO since the Time Warner merger went through a few weeks ago, and the telecom giant has made it clear what it wants from the channel. More subscribers, watching more programming, more hours of the day. But that may not fit very well with HBO's higher-end programming model, a pretty successful model among its pay TV competitors. David Folkenflik is media correspondent for NPR, and he's with us right now. Hi, David.
Hey, Steve.
Now, a quick reminder, AT&T bought Time Warner for more than $85 billion. That deal closed last month. So where are we right now, and what is it that AT&T is saying about HBO?
For HBO, the question has been, well, how do you treat it? How does it be a growth property for them? It turns over a bunch of profit, billions a year in profit for now AT&T. And yet it is something of a boutique outfit. You know, there's a mixture of extremely high profile shows like Game of Thrones and more niche shows that are done that appeal to loyal viewers and also to critics. And that mixture, along with perhaps some you know, shall we say some racier fare, some gently pornographic fare late at night, some stuff about sports, some stuff for kids. They acquired, of course, the first run episodes of Sesame Street and some other things, really knits together an audience. What John Stankey, who's the new head of what's now called Warner Media Properties, has said, Stankey's saying, what you do is great and we want you to do a heck of a lot more of it. And it sounds as though he's saying, hey, this quality thing is fantastic and let's put an emphasis on quantity as well. There's a little bit of subtlety in that. He said that they should have a lot more resources. They'll have a lot of latitude and creative running room to do it. He's really seeing that HBO needs to move out of a more narrowly focused market, and he wants it to be one of the 4 to 6 large players that endure in the world of scripted entertainment.
Stankey had a closed-door town hall meeting with the HBO chief, Richard Plepler, and with HBO's employees. We're talking about 150 people, right? So, and I've got it in front of me. This was the back and forth between Mr. Stankey and Mr. Plepler. Stankey says, we've got to make money at the end of the day, right? We do that, Mr. Plepler responded to some scattered applause. Yes, you do, Mr. Stankey said, just not enough. Now, be right. Careful, Mr. Plepler said. So at the end of this is about making money.
Oh, all of this is about making money. And the question is whether or not HBO, which was part of what was really purely by this point a media company in Time Warner, was sufficiently figuring out ways to capitalize on what it does for AT&T, which not only is a telecoms giant, but sees itself as a data giant as well. In those remarks, at the tail end of the exchange that you just cited, according to the tech site Recode, which also obtained audio of the event, everybody kind of roared with laughter. Now, maybe some of that laughter was nervous, but, you know, it acknowledged that there was sort of a sense in the room of, you know, this guy is asking for more, but also promising creative freedom, always prized by HBO, and that therefore executive freedom to make decisions. But he also talked fascinatingly about competitors, doesn't mention Netflix, although obviously Netflix is the silent giant in the room on this conversation, but he does mention Facebook. And he talks about the ways in which people scrolling online on their mobile devices and tablets and the like receive endorphin rushes from clicking likes and from sharing content, and that he wants to, it would seem, create the same kind of loyalty and tactile investment that people feel upon using social media like Facebook when they're experiencing HBO. That is, he wants people to watch HBO more days of the week, but really more hours every day. And he wants that to be an almost narcotic effect. If what he's really arguing is they're going to have to compete with Netflix and Amazon in particular, and possibly a unified Disney and Fox in the entertainment side of things, he wants them to be big enough to survive and to have the scale that people feel that they are an essential rather than a niche investment for their entertainment dollars every month.
And these two are very different personalities, right? One from the East Coast, one from the West Coast. Stankey was born here in California, more conservative. Plepler's an East Coaster, more liberal. Does that factor into this back and forth between the two?
You know, probably I would, rather than personalizing it, I'd look almost at the corporate cultures of the place. Time Warner, definitely a New York-based proposition with Hollywood assets. AT&T really thinks of itself as, you know, a place from Texas where it emerged from one of the surviving baby bells, right? It is a much more buttoned-up corporate culture. Its leadership has been much more conservative, more likely to support Republicans, more likely to support certain kinds of deregulation when it comes to how internet providers do things, for example. You know, my sense is that AT&T and Time Warner would have been lined up on opposite sides of it. Time Warner not wanting its content disadvantaged by some place like AT&T or Comcast squeezing them once something like net neutrality was knocked aside. AT&T and other providers generally tend to want to be able to control how they allow traffic through their pipes. So these are just different imperatives, and they're, you know, what Stankey is suggesting is that he will be generous and that he will give them a lot of leeway, but that he will also lean hard on them to find more Games of Thrones, to find more big ticket franchises that really draw in viewers of all kinds, perhaps more star power, you know, probably frustrated that a place like Netflix can get House of Cards, you know, wanting to ensure that they get the next franchises that draw people in, and that the billions upon billions of dollars about to be spent by Netflix and Amazon and Apple too in pure streaming plays don't eclipse what they've been building and trying to offer through HBO.
So bottom line, David, and what kind of changes do you think we'll see in HBO? Will we see more programs? Will we see this panoply of different shows that we'll have access to online? How will that work?
I think you're going to see what happens when the programming and intellectual firepower of HBO targets its sights on ramping up to produce more, as though they're almost producing for two HBOs rather than one. Quality is going to be a question. I think they will probably be challenged on some of their judgments because they're going to be more likely to want to get to yes to simply have the hours of programming that will perhaps compel people to get it as a streaming alone service and to spend more time with HBO once they have, whether on cable or online. I think that, you know, I think it puts a lot of pressure on Richard Plepler and his team to keep the standard as high as they do for the kinds of dramatic things that they're involved with. Amazon and Netflix have shown that they can compete in quality and in quantity by just throwing so much money on it. And we tend to forget, of course, the projects that don't live up to the hype or that don't work out. We just don't talk about them that much. And with Netflix, it's sometimes hard to find them because there are so many things to be offered. HBO is now figuring out what it means to be a streaming entertainment company rather than a channel that they're programming for a finite number of hours of the day. They're looking to expand and expand under this new ownership. It's going to be a lot of pressure. It'll be really interesting to see how it plays out.
How it plays out, and it certainly, from decades ago when it was just the set-top box, right? Remember, you used to flip it over, and there was HBO from decades ago. It's a different world today, David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent. David, thank you.
You bet.
Coming up, Northridge, 1982. A family goes missing, presumed murdered. A man goes on trial and a jury acquits him. The latest on a case from a journalist and a former neighbor of the victims. Next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiotakis, and for Madeline Brand. Way back in 1982, a family of four disappeared without a trace from their home on a cul-de-sac in Northridge. Saul Solomon, his wife Elaine, and their two kids, Michelle and Mitchell, were never seen or heard from again. Their bodies never found. Writer Stacy Perman was a friend of Michelle's. She lived on the same street as the Solomons and was actually supposed to be at their house the night that they disappeared. So the event has had a significant impact on her childhood, and she has carried it for years, for decades. So much so that after the Solomons went missing, she made it her personal mission to finally find out what really happened. And Stacy Perman wrote about her quest for Los Angeles Magazine, and she's with us right now on the line. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, Steve.
Tell me what the Solomons were like. Before we get into the story, what was life like on that presumably idyllic suburban street there in Northridge?
Well, that's the thing. It was rather unextraordinary. They were a seemingly normal family. They were extremely social family. Saul and Elaine had a very busy social circle. Their house was always filled with friends. She was very close to her family, her mother, her brother, cousins were always over. But at the same time, even I observed this as a child, a little bit of a split. Saul was an Israeli immigrant, and he had his group of Israeli friends. And while there were social parties, backyard parties, you know, he seemed to huddle with his friends, always speaking Hebrew. And soon all these rumors surfaced that Saul was involved with the Israeli mafia. I should say none of those ties have ever been proven. But, you know, speculation ran rampant. But aside from that, it was a seemingly normal suburban family with a front lawn, a swimming pool in the back, two kids and a dog.
One day, then they were gone. Describe that day that they went missing.
Well, it was an October day. It was, you know, I remember it was hot. It was the fall. School had begun. Michelle and I were going to different schools, but we were always in each other's pockets. And she was over my house that day, as she often was, or I was at her house. But she was at my house that afternoon after school, rummaging through my clothes. She often borrowed my clothes. I remember she left wearing a pair of my new Bermuda shorts. And that night, we were supposed to go with her mom and grandmother to something called a pants party, which is kind of a Tupperware party for clothing. Mm. And then I was going to go back to her house. We'd try on all our clothes and I'd end up sleeping over. And for some unfathomable reason, I changed my mind. And, you know, that was it. And then the next day, it was a Tuesday, in the evening, the neighbor that lived behind the Solomons called my mom and called her and said their pool was overflowing. Would she mind calling them and telling them to shut it down? So my mom called and nobody answered the phone. And that was a little strange because of the time of day. It was a little around dinner time. Someone was always there. And so my mom said, hey, let's just walk down there. It was just a few doors down. Let's just knock on the door. And we went and it was dark. There was no life. I remember vividly Saul had this Rolls Royce and it was parked in the driveway.
A Rolls Royce in Northridge.
Yes, yes, yeah. Yes. It was a little bit of the talk of the street, to be honest. And, you know, became a bit of a, I guess, a player in the story overall. But, you know, my mom and I went to the back. We saw the pool was flooded. The backyard was flooded, excuse me. The dog was there, didn't stir. And it was strange. We went back home and then my mom, you know, made all these calls to the relatives, the friends. You know, nobody had seen them for 24 hours. And the next call my mom made was to the police.
All right. So your mom called the cops and the cops showed up, right? What happened then?
So the cops showed up. We waited in front. And Elaine's cousin, Doreen Laffer, they were like sisters. She had actually swung by earlier in the day to drop off some borrowed chairs. And she also had found nobody home and found it unusual and had her husband, Marty, stop by, too. So he actually showed up around the time the cops came. And the cops made sort of this cursory look of the house and didn't find anything unusual or any, you know, sort of incident of foul play and said, you know, can't really help you. But Marty insisted. He said, this is very unusual. Whenever, you know, he made this remark, you know, whenever Elaine went to the bathroom, someone would know about it. This isn't right. There are two kids involved. There was a lot of talking, backing and, you know, back and forth to the station. They got a sergeant to come out and get permission to enter. And Marty showed them how they could get into the house through a bathroom in the back. And we all went into the house. And it looked, you know, normal. On the surface, it looked normal. In fact, Marty went into the master bedroom and called his wife, Doreen, and said, yeah, everything's fine, even the bed's made. And that's when she panicked because she said, Elaine never made the beds. My mom and I went home, and within short order, the house was crawling with dozens of cops, and they made a closer inspection and found blood droplets in Michelle's bedroom. Her bed was broken. There was some blood on sheets, and a piece of the carpet was missing.
All right, so here we are. The police are there. We police believe that this is a homicide investigation. They're looking at suspects. And we have this man named Harvey Rader. Where does Harvey Rader fit into this?
Well, Harvey Rader was a business associate of Saul's. And that night they had gone to a car auction together. And he was the last known person to have seen Saul that evening. But also, as it turns out, it was possibly that he was the last person to see Elaine as well, because about 11:30 that night, she was on the phone with a friend of hers and the doorbell rang and she said, I have to go. Harvey's at the door. And that was the last anybody had heard of the family. And Harvey was known to the police for a number of reasons and he became a person of interest, but they couldn't connect him to the murders because there was no evidence and there certainly was no bodies. And so the case sort of dragged on for 6 years until the family had hired this private investigator who believed that a man named Ashley Paul, who was Harvey Rader's cousin, knew more than he let on. And by this time, Ashley Paul, it was 6 years later, had moved back to England. And Samson, this private investigator, flew there many times, tried to pressure him to break, and he wouldn't. And then finally he did after he played some shenanigans and had somebody call and threaten him.
Mm.
And then he told him what happened, this terrible, ugly, grisly story of going to the house or shooting Saul and then going to the house, killing the family, stuffing them in a Mercedes and burying them out in the desert.
All right. So there were three trials. Two of them ended in mistrial. And then the last one, what happened?
He was acquitted because by this point, Ashley Paul had made these statements to the LAPD in exchange for immunity. But the immunity deal was poorly worded and it was thrown out. And it was the judge believed that he was coerced into compromising himself. And so his statements were thrown out and actually they were put under seal. So without Ashley Paul, it was a very circumstantial case to begin with. Without Ashley Paul, it was a pretty thin case. I guess they threw the dice and they lost and he was acquitted.
He was acquitted. And here we are so many years later. Where does the case stand?
Right. Well, you know, when I went back, my initial goal was just to find out what happened. You know, I went at this. It was a little surreal for me because I was doing this as a, you know, there were two spaces in my head. I was a kid and I was an adult journalist. And it wasn't like I was going after this to find, you know, the real killer. I think the police found somebody. They had a bead on him. There were a number of blunders, both at the district attorney's office, as it appeared, and in the police investigation. So for me, it was what happened. And this is what happened. Rader was acquitted. Double jeopardy applies. He'll never be tried for this again. Ashley Paul was initially arrested based on his statements because he implicated himself in the murders, but legally the judge let him go because of the way the immunity deal was worded. So unless he decides to come back to California and say something, he'll never be tried. The other, you know, it's a tragedy on so many levels, but not least of which, you know, to this day, the bodies have never been found. And every few years, the LAPD or the sheriff's office do these search and rescue exercises in the desert, in the mine shafts. That area is, you know, dotted with all these mine shafts. And every so often, they go specifically looking for the Solomons, but they've yet to find their bodies.
Fascinating story. Stacey Perman, journalist, former neighbor of the Solomons. You can read her article, An Entire Family Disappeared from Their Valley Home. What Happened to the Solomons, in Los Angeles Magazine. Stacey, thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Coming up, the Ebola outbreak that began in 2014 killed more than 11,000 people before it was brought under control. After a recent smaller outbreak of the virus in the Congo, science writer Ed Yong is concerned that the United States and the world are gravely unprepared for the next big epidemic.
It's really a question of when, not if, the next thing will emerge. It could be something we know like Ebola. It could be something completely new that we haven't heard of before.
The next plague and its consequences. That's coming up on Press Play. Press Play on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis, in for Madeline Brand. Well, 4 years ago, there was a worldwide panic after an Ebola outbreak.
The head of the CDC warning that the outbreak in Africa is even worse than we feared.
The CDC is raising its alert to the highest level,
trying to halt the further spread of one of the world's most virulent diseases, which has no vaccine and no cure.
More than 11,000 people died before it was brought under control, but Ebola didn't go away. Recently, there was a smaller outbreak in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. 28 people died in a matter of months there. Well, the World Health Organization announced a few weeks ago that the outbreak has been, quote, largely contained, their words. So what did we learn from the last major outbreak? And what will happen when, not if, but when another infectious disease outbreak, such as Ebola or the flu or bubonic plague, becomes a global pandemic? Science writer Ed Yong says America and the world are unprepared. He's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and he's done a deep exploration in this for the July and August issue of the magazine. It's called The Next Plague Is Coming, Is America Ready? And Ed Yong spoke with Madeline Brand recently.
Let's talk about Ebola. You actually visited the gravesite of victims of a previous Ebola outbreak back in 1995 in the Congo. So what did you learn from going to the site of that outbreak in terms of what we need to know now?
Right. So the current outbreak is the ninth the country has experienced. And one of its earliest ones happened to a city called Kikwit in 1995. And that was one of the ones that brought Ebola to the global stage. And I think one of the really interesting things that I found going back there is that not that much has changed in terms of people's practices. There is still a lot of eating of bushmeat. There's been a reasonable amount of forgetfulness. A lot of resources that were once allocated to dealing with Ebola should it return have disappeared. And this is a common theme in a lot of the reporting I've done in the US too, that when these crises hit, people panic and they throw a lot of attention and money and resources at the problem. But over time, that attention dwindles and panic gives way to neglect. And we seem to be caught in these perpetual cycles of almost getting to the cusp of readiness and then slipping away again just as we get there.
Mm. So when it comes to Ebola, you mentioned that people are still eating bushmeat. Is that the primary form of transmission? It's coming from animals like monkeys and transmitted to humans that way?
So a lot of these things come from animals. They spill over into humans. The exact reservoir of Ebola is still unknown. Many people think it's some kind of bat, but we still don't know what the specific thing is. But, you know, in general, you have this very large, dense population of people who are sort of pushing into areas of wilderness. That's true in the Congo. It's true in many other parts of the world. And our growing human population does expose us to the wide variety of viral threats that are out there. So it feels like it's really a question of when, not if, the next thing will emerge. It could be something we know like Ebola. It could be something completely new that we haven't heard of before. It could be something that is known but that wasn't recognized to be a threat. Zika virus was discovered in Uganda in the 1940s, and it was only very recently that we understood that it can cause problems like microcephaly in babies and only recently that it became this epidemic of global significance.
And then we don't have to travel far to see what can happen when a disease becomes out of control, when we just look at the last flu season, because lots of people were hospitalized. I think pediatric deaths hit a record high. I think 169 babies died. Hospitals were overrun, and that was just the flu.
That was just the flu, and not even a pandemic flu, too, just a kind of bad strain of seasonal flu. And
what's the difference? So
seasonal flus are strains that circulate around the world every year. Pandemic flus tend to be new strains that people haven't seen before, which then just go out of control. Even without a pandemic, flu does kill significant numbers of people around the world all the time. And, you know, the fact that flu, of all things, could strain our healthcare system so badly as we saw this year should be a source of concern for us. You know, this is a disease that we do have at least some antivirals for, even if they're not always great. It is a disease where we can produce vaccines. We have the infrastructure for that. That just doesn't exist for the vast majority of other emerging infectious disease threats. And I think the fact that this flu season was so bad, the fact that the 2009 flu pandemic, even though it was caused by a mild mild strain also cause severe problems for our health infrastructure should be a cause of severe concern to us. It shows the degree to which we are still unprepared. I went to a biocontainment unit in the University of Nebraska Medical Center, which treated Ebola patients in the 2014 West African outbreak. And they are arguably one of the best prepared places in the country to deal with diseases like Ebola. But they are only able to do that because for at least 9 years before the outbreak happened, people in the hospital said, we need to be able to deal with this, and invested time, attention, space and money into creating the kinds of equipment and facilities needed to deal with a disease like Ebola. And it's that kind of foresight and that ability to retain investments even in times when no immediate threat is on the horizon that is both largely absent and is sorely needed.
Right. And you talked to Bill Gates about that, and he is ever the optimist, thinking that there are solutions for every problem around the corner. But he seemed particularly pessimistic when you talked to him about this.
Right. His narrative is one of global progress and optimism. But his view on pandemic preparedness was, boy, we do not have our act together. For a man like Gates to be this worried is, I think, very telling. Philanthropists like him can't fix this problem on their own. We need governments and societies to step up, too. And sadly, that doesn't seem to be the case. There are a few glimmers of hope. I don't want to freak out our listeners entirely. The agency called BARDA, which is sort of like a venture capital firm nested within the government, it does provide funding for countermeasures against potential pandemics. There is a new organization called CEPI, which is creating vaccines against new diseases like Lassa fever and Nipah virus and MERS ahead of time so that they'll be ready for the next potential outbreak. But, these examples, I think, are relatively few and far between, and we definitely need more attention and more investment to be paid into this very crucial area, in much the same way that the US recognizes that in order to prepare for future wars, it needs to invest in military spending and in bolstering our military defenses, but against viruses and other pathogens, which are threats capable of causing far more devastation and loss of life than any rogue state, those investments are nowhere to be seen. And that is a shame.
Mm. Well, also, there are different ways of, if you want to use the military analogy, different ways of seeing a threat and trying to counteract a threat. You can either be defensive and build up your defenses at home, or you can go abroad and do things like nation building, try to prevent the threat from emerging in the first place. So what would be the equivalent that the United States could do with nation building when it comes to diseases?
So the United States actually has a very good track record of this historically. We are the world's biggest spender in global health. And this has been the case for a lot of past administrations, both Republican and Democrat. There is an agreement called the Global Health Security Agenda that the U.S. has committed a lot of money to help other countries bolster their abilities to prevent, detect, and control their own outbreaks. But sadly, a lot of the funding that was dedicated towards that has started running out. And Trump's budget for 2019 would cut the current operating standard of that agenda by about 67%. It would force the CDC and other agencies to pull back from countries in which they have spent a significant amount of effort trying to build capacity. And that would be a huge shame. It would leave the world more vulnerable. And because the entire world is so connected, it would therefore leave the U.S. more vulnerable.
Okay, so that's a dispiriting thought. What can local health agencies do to try to prevent a major outbreak if it does come to the United States?
There are a few things, you know, making sure that people are trained, making sure that you have contingency plans, you have stockpiles. Nebraska is a really good example for this. When I went to see them, they had thought about almost every aspect of hospital life and how it might respond to a pandemic. Like, where do you triage people who are sick in the hospital? How many face masks do we need to stockpile? They've done a lot of planning. But, you know, as we've said, I think ultimately the stage in which this is going to play out is going to be overseas. It's going to be in our ability to help other countries boost their own health systems. There is stuff we can do to make sure America is ready, but those efforts can't exist only within America's borders. They also have to involve the entire world. It is this ethic of global cooperation that I think is ultimately going to be our salvation.
Well, Ed, thank you very much.
No, thank you for having me. This was great.
My pleasure. That's Ed Yong. He's a science writer for The Atlantic and author of the book I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us and a Grander View of Life.
Coming up, the World Cup final is set, and the winner is... Oh, we're not going to tell you. You're going to have to wait for that. But our sport correspondent and resident Norwegian is next with the latest on football on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's been almost a month since the first game of the World Cup kicked off in Moscow. But now, after semifinal games yesterday and today, there are only two games left. The third place game is on Saturday, but the final is set for Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific. And here's a spoiler alert for anyone taping today's semifinal between England and Croatia. I'm about to talk about what happened in that game today, but we're not going to tell you exactly what happened just yet. I'm going to bring in Christian Bordahl, our resident Norwegian, our sport correspondent here at KCRW.
Hey there, Steve.
How are you, Christian?
Good. Oh, boy. Yes.
Talk about the game.
Well, it was an incredible game. Yeah. This World Cup has been so exciting and so many overtime games and really close games. This game started off very, very well for England. In only the fifth minute, their right wing back, a guy named Kieran Trippier, plays for Tottenham in the Premier League. He got to take a free kick. He's been taking them all during this World Cup for England, and he hasn't looked terribly convincing doing it. But this time, he scored a beautiful goal, and English fans were very happy. That's some of the locals
just
at the King's Head
here. Just under
the beat
of hooligans right there. Just
exactly.
Under there.
So, it's always a little difficult when you score that early because then you have to figure out how you're going to play the rest of the game.
Defending that goal, absolutely.
Well, you can play defensively, and after a while, in fact, particularly in the second half, England did start getting a little passive and defensive. Croatia took advantage. They started pressing the attack, and in the 67th minute, maybe somewhere around there, Croatia put a ball into the box, and a Croatian player scores. And that's the way it stays. 1-1 through regulation, and we go into overtime.
Regulation is about 90 minutes, right?
Exactly. Regulation is 90 minutes, and then overtime is another 30 minutes. Mm. You have injury time added to that, so these guys played like 130-odd minutes of soccer.
But we're tied 1-1 at that point.
We're tied 1-1.
It's got to be tiring, right? We're already at how many? 110, 115 minutes.
So they've played 90 minutes regulation. They play some injury time. They get into the overtime. That's another 30 minutes. And fatigue is a big factor. You know, it's a running game. People have to run the field, chasing forward, chasing back. And in the first half, England looked pretty good. They had a corner kick, a header almost went in. It was cleared right off the goal line by a Croatian defender. In the second half, Croatia started pressing the attack again. They got a ball into the box, and boom, they scored. Croatia goes up 2-1.
Yeah.
English
fans
must have
been
10 minutes left.
That was a punch in the gut.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Croatia saw it through. And Croatia beats England 2-1. And indeed, English fans are gutted, as they say. In fact, though, I have to say, English fans probably are also really ecstatic about how far the team went. I mean, they haven't made it to the semifinal since about 1990, since 1990, in fact.
You just buried the lead, by the way.
Tell me. Tell me, which lead did I bury?
Well, the lead was the score, the final score, Brian. I mean, yes. It took where we were about 5 minutes in, but it was good that we got it in.
The final score, 2-1 Croatia. England and the English fans, very unhappy, obviously, but very pleased that they got as far as they did. It's been a huge, fun thing for English fans. But, you know, they kind of expect this thing because they've had such a hard time in the World Cup. I actually talked to the guy named Roger Bennett, who was on a TV show called Men in Blazers just before the World Cup started. And this is what he had to say about that.
In my lifetime, England have always gone through this unbelievable cycle of believing that this time the trophy is ours. We're going to bring back the glory that the fans deserve, the players would say before heading off to the tournament, only to find a savage way to self-sabotage and to crash out and trigger a just national agony that will take 4 years to heal.
There's tears in that tea. Yeah, my goodness.
That's how it is for the English, I'm afraid.
But delight in Dubrovnik, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Very, very happy Croatian fans. In fact, we have a little tape of that. This is what it sounds like in a downtown Croatian church today.
Wow.
There you go.
They were listening to him pounding on the pews over there. I hope they didn't do any destruction. That was St. Anthony's church over in downtown L.A. So, Christian, how does this set up? Now, we've got the third-place game on Saturday, right?
Right. So, third-place game on Saturday is going to be between England and Belgium. They actually played already once. They were in the group together. So they played once before, but at that point it didn't matter because both of them had already won through to the round of 16. And so England was actually perfectly happy to lose that game because it turned out that if they lost, they would be up against Colombia and Sweden as opposed to having to play people like Belgium and Brazil.
Yeah.
Which is what happened with Belgium, of course. They ended up coming up against France in the semifinal, which was the other semifinal, which was a great game yesterday. Those are two really skilled teams.
You want to win every game, but there is strategy in losing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. In the World Cup.
So this time it'll be, England is definitely going to be going all out to win that game on Saturday. And then, of course, we've got France going up against the Croats now in the final on Sunday at 8 a.m. So that's going to be an exciting game.
You know, Christian, I mean, we have been watching this, and I am, honestly, for the past couple of weeks, I'm flummoxed by how excited people have been about this tournament.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, soccer is definitely, I mean, around here in L.A., soccer is incredibly popular.
Oh, that's a diverse population.
Yeah, it's a diverse population. You've got a lot of Latinos watching the game. You've got a lot of, like, English, British expats watching the game. And, of course, a lot of Americans now have grown up playing the game. You know, I coach soccer here in town. And for the younger population, like 18 to 35, we talked about this before, the Gallup poll says that soccer is the second most popular game. Tied with basketball, and second to football. So there's plenty of people out there who are watching these games, even though, obviously, America didn't make it in. And so there was...
Not even from the get-go, yeah. So, and there were a lot of people watching in many home countries, too. A lot of people relishing their time back at home.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, today's score, and it just finished, just wrapped up not too long ago. We've got 2-1 Croatia beating England today. That sets up the match for the final, the World Cup final, and France and Croatia. That's Sunday, 8 a.m.
That's
Los Angeles time.
Yep.
Christian Bordahl. And my condolences to you, too, on your British team. No tears in your tea today.
No,
Always a smile on our resident Norwegian's face. Christian Bordahl, that's Press Play for today. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Madeline's back tomorrow. Have a great day.